Chapter 52. Pyramus and Thisbe. About the centre of the Faubourg Saint-Honoré, and at the back of one of the most distinguished-looking mansions in this rich neighbourhood, where the various hotels vie with each other for elegance of design and magnificence of construction, extended a large garden, whose widely spreading chestnut trees raised their heads above the walls high and solid as those of a rampart, scattering each spring a shower of delicate pink and white blossoms into the large stone vases, placed at equal distances upon the two square pilasters, supporting an iron gate, curiously wrought, after the style and manner of the reign of Louis XIV. This noble entrance, however, in spite of its striking appearance and the graceful effect of the geraniums planted in the two vases, as they waved their variegated leaves in the wind and charmed the eye with their scarlet bloom, had fallen into utter disuse, from the period when the proprietors of the hotel, and many years had elapsed since then, had confined themselves to the possession of the hotel with its thickly planted courtyard opening into the Faubourg Saint-Honoré, and the garden shut in by this gate, which formerly communicated with a fine kitchen garden of about an acre in extent. But the demon of speculation having drawn a line, or in other words, projected a street at the extremity of this kitchen garden, and even before the foundations of the said street were dug, its name being duly affixed upon an iron plate at the corner of the situation chosen, it occurred to the then possessor of the hotel we are describing that a handsome sum might be obtained for the ground now devoted to fruits and vegetables, for the purpose of adding it to the projected street intended to form a great branch of communication with the Faubourg Saint-Honoré itself, one of the most important thoroughfares in the city of Paris. In the matters of speculation, however, though man proposes, yet money disposes. From some such difficulty the newly named street died almost in birth, and the purchaser of the kitchen garden, having paid a high price for it, and being quite unable to find anyone willing to take his bargain off his hands without a considerable loss, yet still clinging to the belief that at some future day he should obtain a sum for it that would repay him not only for his past outlay, but also the interest upon the capital locked up in his new acquisition, contented himself with letting the ground temporarily to some market gardeners, at a yearly rent of 500 francs. Thus, then, as already stated, the iron gate leading into the kitchen garden had been closed up and left to the rust, which bade fair to destroy its hinges ere long, while to prevent the ignoble glances of the diggers and delvers of the ground from presuming to sully the aristocratical enclosure belonging to the hotel, the gate in question had been boarded up to a height of 6 feet. True, the planks were not closely adjusted, but that a hasty peep might be obtained between their interstices, but the strict decorum and rigid propriety of the inhabitants of the hotel left no grounds for apprehending that advantage would be taken of that circumstance. Horticulture seemed, however, to have been abandoned in the deserted kitchen garden, and where the most choice and delicate of fruits and vegetables once reared their heads, a scanty crop of lucerne alone bore evidence of its being deemed worthy of cultivation. A small, low door gave egress from the walled space we have been describing into the projected street, the ground having been abandoned as unproductive by its various renters, and had now fallen so completely in general estimation as to return not even a fraction of the poor 10 shillings per cent it had originally paid. Towards the hotel, the chestnut trees we have before mentioned rose high above the wall, without in any way affecting the growth of other luxuriant shrubs and flowers that eagerly pressed forward to fill up the vacant spaces, as though asserting their right to enjoy the boon of light and air also. At one corner, where the foliage became so thick as almost to shut out day, a large stone bench and sundry rustic seats indicated that this sheltered spot was either in general favour or particular use by some inhabitant of the hotel, which was faintly discernible through the dense mass of verdure that partially concealed it, though situated but 100 paces off. Whoever had selected this retired portion of the grounds as the boundary of their walks or scene of their meditative musings was abundantly justified in their choice by the absence of all glare, the cool, refreshing shade, the screen it afforded from the scorching rays of the sun that found no entrance there even during the burning days of hottest summer, the incessant and melodious warbling of birds, and the entire removal from either the noise of the street or the bustle of the hotel. On the evening of one of the warmest days spring had yet bestowed on the inhabitants of Paris, might be seen, negligently thrown upon the stone bench, a book, a parasol, and a work-basket, from which hung a partly embroidered cambric handkerchief, while at a little distance from these articles was a young female, standing close to the iron gate, endeavouring to discern something on the other side by means of the openings in the planks, whilst the earnestness of her attitude and the fixed gaze with which she seemed to seek the object of her wishes proved how much her feelings were interested in the matter. At that instant the little side door leading from the waste ground to the street was noiselessly opened, and a tall, powerful young man dressed in a common grey blouse and velvet cap, but whose carefully arranged hair, beard and moustaches, all of the richest and glossiest black, ill accorded with his plebeian attire, and after casting a rapid glance around him in order to assure himself he was unobserved, entered by this door, and carefully closing and securing it after him, proceeded with a hurried step towards the iron gate. At the sight of him she expected, though probably not under such a costume, the female we have before mentioned started in terror and was about to make a hasty retreat. But the eye of love had already seen the movement of the white robe and observed the fluttering of the blue sash fastened around the slender waist of his fair neighbour. Pressing his lips close to the envious planks that prevented his further progress, he exclaimed, "Fear nothing, Valentine, it is I." Again the timid girl found courage to return to the gate, saying, as she did so, "And wherefore come you so late to-day? It is almost a dinner hour, and I have been compelled to exercise my utmost skill to get rid of the incessant watchfulness of my stepmother, as well as the espionage of my maid, who no doubt is employed to report all I do and say. Nor has it cost me a little trouble to free myself from the troublesome society of my brother, under pretence of coming hither to work undisturbed at my embroidery, which, by the way, I am in no hurry to finish. So pray excuse yourself as well as you can for having made me wait, and after that tell me why I see you in so singular a dress that at first I did not recognize you."
"Dearest Valentine," said the young man, "the difference between our respective stations makes me fear to offend you by speaking of my love, but yet I cannot find myself in your presence without longing to pour forth my soul and to tell you how fondly I adore you. If it be but to carry away with me the recollection of such sweet moments, I could even bless. Thank you for chiding me, for it leaves me a gleam of hope that if not expecting me, and that indeed would be worse than vanity of me to suppose, at least I was in your thoughts. You asked me the cause of my being late, as also why I come thus disguised. I will candidly explain the reason of both, and I trust your goodness to pardon me. But let me tell you first, I have chosen a trade."
"A trade? Oh, Maximilian, how can you jest at a time when we have such deep cause for uneasiness?"
"Heaven keep me from jesting with that which is far dearer to me than life itself. But listen to me, Valentine, and I will tell you all about it. Tired out with ranging fields and scaling walls, and seriously alarmed at the idea suggested by yourself that if caught hovering about here your father would very likely have me sent to prison as a thief, a sort of thing not very desirable for an officer in the French army, whose continual presence in a place where no warlike projects could be supposed to account for it might well create surprise, so from a captain of spies I have become a gardener, and consequently adopted the costume of my calling."
"What excessive nonsense you talk, Maximilian!"
"Nonsense! Pray do not call what I consider the wisest action of my life by such a name. Consider, by becoming a gardener, I effectually screen our meetings from all suspicion or danger."
"I beseech of you, Maximilian, to cease trifling, and tell me what you really mean."
"Simply that having ascertained that the piece of ground on which I stand was to let, I made application for it, was readily accepted by the proprietor, and am now master of this fine crop of lucerne. Think of that, Valentine. It is nothing now to prevent my building myself a little hut on my plantation, and residing not 20 yards from you. Only imagine what happiness that would afford me. I can scarcely contain myself at the bare idea. Such felicity seems above all price, as a thing impossible and unattainable. But would you believe that I purchase all this delight, joy, and happiness, for which I would cheerfully have surrendered 10 years of my life, at the small cost of 500 francs per annum, paid quarterly? Henceforth we have nothing to fear. I am on my own ground, and have an undoubted right to place a ladder against the wall, and to look over when I please, without having any apprehensions of being taken off by the police as a suspicious character. I may also enjoy the precious privilege of assuring you of my fond, faithful, and unalterable affection whenever you visit your favourite bower. Unless, indeed, it offends your pride to listen to professions of love from the lips of a poor working man clad in a blouse and cap.
A faint cry of mingled pleasure and surprise escaped from the lips of Valentine, who almost instantly said, in a saddened tone, as though some envious cloud darkened the joy which illumined her heart,
"Alas, no, Maximilian, this must not be for many reasons. We should presume too much on our own strength, and, like others, perhaps, be led astray by our blind confidence in each other's prudence."
"How can you for an instant entertain so unworthy a thought, dear Valentine? Have I not, from the first blessed hour of our acquaintance, schooled all my words and actions to your sentiments and ideas? And you have, I am sure, the fullest confidence in my honour. When you spoke to me of your experiencing a vague and indefinite sense of coming danger, I placed myself blindly and devotedly at your service, asking no other reward than the pleasure of being useful to you. And have I ever since, by word or look, given you cause of regret for having selected me from the numbers that would willingly have sacrificed their lives for you? You told me, my dear Valentine, that you were engaged to Monsieur d'Épinay, and that your father was resolved upon completing the match, and that from his will there was no appeal, as Monsieur de Villefort was never known to change a determination once formed. I kept in the background as you wished, waiting not the decision of your heart or my own, but hoping Providence would graciously interpose in our behalf, and order events in our favour. But what cared I for delays or difficulties, so long as my sweet Valentine confessed she loved me, and accepted my fervent vows of unfailing constancy? Blessed avowal, the very recollection of which can at all times raise me even from despair itself. To hear you repeat those enrapturing words from time to time is all I ask, and to obtain that privilege I would cheerfully endure even double my present disquietudes.
Ah, Maximilian, that is the very thing that makes you so bold, and which renders me at once so happy and unhappy, that I frequently ask myself whether it is better for me to endure the harshness of my stepmother and her blind preference for her own child, or to be, as I now am, insensible to my pleasure save such as I find in these our meetings, so fraught with danger to both.
"I will not admit that word," returned the young man. "It is at once cruel and unjust. Is it possible to find a more submissive slave than myself? You have permitted me to converse with you from time to time, Valentine, but forbidden my ever following you in your walks or elsewhere. Have I not obeyed? And since I found means to enter this enclosure to exchange a few words with you through this door, to be close to you without being enabled to obtain a view of your dear features, have I even solicited to touch the tip of your glove through the small openings of the palisades? Think you that at my age, and with my strength, this wall that now parts us would keep me from your side one instant, were it not that my respect for your wishes presents an impassable barrier? Never has a complaint or a murmur of your rigour escaped me. I have been bound by my promises as rigidly as any knight of olden times. Come, come, dearest Valentine, confess that what I say is true, lest I be tempted to call you unjust."
"It is indeed most true," said Valentine,
as she passed the end of her slender fingers through a small opening in the planks, thus permitting her lover to press his lips to the taper fingers that almost instantly disappeared.
"And you are a true and faithful friend. But still you acted from motives of self-interest, my dear Maximilian, for you well knew that from the moment in which you had manifested an opposite spirit, all would have been ended between us. You promised to bestow on me the friendly affection of a brother. I, who have no friend but yourself upon earth, who am neglected and forgotten by my father, harassed and persecuted by my stepmother, and left to the sole companionship of a paralysed and speechless old man whose withered hand can no longer press mine, and whose eye alone converses with me, while, doubtless, however fixed, chilled his frame, there still lingers in his heart the warmest tenderness for his poor grandchild. Oh, how bitter a fate is mine to serve either as a victim or an enemy to all who are stronger than myself, while my only friend and supporter is but a living corpse. Indeed, Maximilian, I am very miserable, and you are right to love me for myself alone."
"Dear Valentine," replied the young man, deeply affected, "I will not say you are all I love in the world, for I dearly prize my sister and brother-in-law, but my affection for them is calm and tranquil, in no manner resembling that I feel for you. At the merest thoughts of you my heart beats more quickly, my blood flows with increased rapidity through my veins, and my breast heaves with tumultuous emotions. But I solemnly promise you to restrain all this ardour, this fervour and intensity of feeling, until you yourself shall require me to render them available in serving or assisting you. Monsieur France is not expected to return home for a year to come, I am told. In that time many favourable and unforeseen chances may befriend us. Let us then hope for the best. Hope is so sweet a comforter. Meanwhile, Valentine, while reproaching me with selfishness, think a little what you have been to me, the beautiful but cold resemblance of a marble Venus. What promise of future reward have you made me for all the submission and obedience I have evinced? None whatever. What granted me? Scarcely more. You tell me of Monsieur France d'Épinay, your betrothed lover, and you shrink from the idea of being his wife. But tell me, Valentine, is there no other sorrow in your heart? You see me devoted to your body and soul, my life, and each warm drop that circles round my heart are consecrated to your service. You know full well that my existence is bound up in yours, that were I to lose you, I would not outlive the hour of such crushing misery. Yet you speak with calmness of the prospect of your being the wife of another. Oh, Valentine, were I in your place, and did I feel conscious as you do of being worshipped, adored, with such a love as mine, 100 times at least should I have passed my hand between these iron bars, and said to poor Maximilian, "Take this hand, dearest Maximilian, and believe that, living or dead, I am yours, yours only, and forever." The poor girl made no reply, but her lover could plainly hear her sobs. A rapid change took place in the young man's feelings.
"Dearest, dearest Valentine," exclaimed he, "forgive me if I have offended you, and forget the words I spoke if they have unwittingly caused you pain." "No, Maximilian, I am not offended," answered she. "But do you not see what a poor, helpless being I am, almost a stranger and an outcast in my father's house, where even he is seldom seen, whose will has been thwarted and spirits broken from the age of 10 years beneath the iron rod so sternly exercised over me, oppressed, mortified, and persecuted day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute. No person has cared for, even observed, my sufferings, nor have I ever breathed one word on the subject, save to yourself. Outwardly, and in the eyes of the world, I am surrounded by kindness and affection. But the reverse is the case. The general remark is, 'Oh, it cannot be expected that one of so stern a character as Monsieur Villefort could lavish the tenderness some fathers do on their daughters.' What, though she has lost her own mother at a tender age, she has had the happiness to find a second mother in Madame de Villefort. The world, however, is mistaken. My father abandons me from utter indifference, while my stepmother detests me with a hatred so much the more terrible as it is veiled beneath a continual smile.
"Hate you, sweet Valentine?" exclaimed the young man. "How is it possible for anyone to do that?"
"Alas," replied the weeping girl, "I am obliged to own that my stepmother's aversion to me arises from a very natural source, her overweening love for her own child, my brother Edward."
"But why should it?"
"Nay, I know not. But though unwilling to introduce money matters into our present conversation, I will just say this much, that her extreme dislike to me has its origin in mercenary motives. And I much fear she envies me the fortune I already enjoy in right of my mother, and which will be more than doubled at the death of Monsieur and Madame de Saint-Méran, whose sole heiress I am. Madame de Villefort has nothing of her own, and hates me for being so richly endowed. Alas, how gladly would I exchange the half of this wealth for the happiness of at least sharing my father's love. God knows I would prefer sacrificing the whole so that it would obtain me a happy and affectionate home."
"Poor Valentine!
I seem to myself as though living a life of bondage, yet at the same time am so conscious of my own weakness that I fear to break the restraint in which I am held, lest I fall utterly powerless and helpless. Then, too, my father is not a person whose orders may be infringed with impunity. Protected as he is by his high position, and firmly established reputation for talent and unswerving integrity, no one could oppose him. He is all-powerful with even his king. You he would crush at a word, and myself he would cause to expire of terror at his feet. Dear Maximilien, believe me when I assure you that I attempt not to resist my father's commands more on your account than my own, for though I could willingly sacrifice myself, I would not peril your safety.
But wherefore, my sweet Valentine, do you persist in anticipating the worst, and in viewing everything through so gloomy a medium? Why picture the future so fraught with evil?
Because I judge it from the past.
Still, consider that although I may not be, strictly speaking, what is termed an illustrious match for you, I am for many reasons not altogether so much beneath your alliance. The days when such distinctions were so nicely weighed and considered no longer exist in France, and the first families of the monarchy have intermarried with those of the empire. The aristocracy of the lance has allied itself with the nobility of the cannon. Now I belong to this last-named class, and certainly my prospects of military preferment are most encouraging as well as certain. My fortune, though small, is free and unfettered, and the memory of my late father respected in our country, Valentine, as that of the most upright and honourable merchant of the city. I say our country because you were born not far from Marseille.
Name not Marseille, I beseech you, Maximilien. That one word brings back my mother to my recollection, my angel mother, who died too soon for myself and all who knew her, but who, after watching over her child, during the brief period allotted to her in this world, now I fondly hope and fully believe contemplates her with pitying tenderness from those realms of bliss to which her pure spirit has flown. Ah, were she still living, we need fear nothing, Maximilien. For I would confide our love to her, and she would aid and protect us.
I fear, Valentine, replied the lover, that were she living, I should never have had the happiness of knowing you. You would then have been too happy to have stooped from your grandeur to bestow a thought on a humble, obscure individual like myself.
It is you who are unkind, aye, and unjust too now, Maximilien, cried Valentine. But there is one thing I wish to know.
And what is that? Inquired the young man,
perceiving that Valentine hesitated and seemed at a loss how to proceed.
End of Disc 17. Disc 18.
But there is one thing I wish to know.
And what is that?
Inquired the young man, perceiving that Valentine hesitated and seemed at a loss how to proceed.
Tell me truly, Maximilien, whether in former days, when our fathers dwelt at Marseille, there ever existed any misunderstanding between them?
Not that I am at all aware of, replied the young man, unless indeed any ill feeling might have arisen from their being of opposite parties, your father being, as you know, a jealous partisan of the Bourbons, while mine was wholly devoted to the Emperor. There could not possibly be any other difference between them. But now that I have answered your question to the best of my power and knowledge, tell me, dearest, why you ask?
I will, replied his fair companion, for it is but right you should know all. Then I must begin by referring to the day when your being made an officer of the Legion of Honour was publicly announced in the papers. We were all sitting in the apartments of my grandfather, Monsieur Noirtier. Monsieur Danglars was there also. You recollect Monsieur Danglars, do you not, Maximilien? The banker whose horses ran away with my stepmother and little brother and very nearly killed them. While the rest of the company were discussing the approaching marriage of Mademoiselle Danglars, I was occupied in reading the paper aloud to my grandfather. But when I came to the paragraph concerning you, although I had done nothing else but read it over to myself all the morning, you know you had told me all about it the previous evening, I felt so happy and yet so nervous at the idea of pronouncing your beloved name aloud and before so many people that I really think I should have passed it over. But for the fear that my so doing might create suspicions as to the cause of my silence, so I summoned up all my courage and read it as firmly and steadily as I could.
Dear Valentine!
Well, would you believe it, directly my father caught the sound of your name, he turned round quite hastily and, Like a poor, silly thing, I was so persuaded that everyone must be as much affected as myself by the utterance of your name, that I was not surprised to see my father start and almost tremble. But I even thought, though that surely must have been a mistake, that Monsieur Danglars underwent a similar emotion. "Morel, Morel!" cried my father. "Stop a bit." Then, knitting his brows into a deep frown, he added, "Surely this cannot be one of the Morel family who lived at Marseille and gave us so much trouble from their being such violent Bonapartists. I mean about the year 1815. "I fancy," replied Monsieur Danglars, "that the individual alluded to in the journal Mademoiselle is reading is the son of the large shipowner there."
"Indeed,"
answered Maximilien.
"And what said your father then, Valentine?"
"Oh, such a dreadful thing, I dare not repeat it."
"Nay, dearest," said the young man, "be not afraid to tell me. Say, what was it?"
"Ah," continued my father, still frowning severely, "their idolized emperor treated these madmen as they deserved. He called them food for cannon, which was precisely all they were good for, and I am delighted to see the present government have adopted this salutary principle with all its pristine vigour. If Algiers were good for nothing but to furnish out the means of carrying so admirable an idea into practice, it would be an acquisition well worthy of struggling to obtain, though it certainly does cost France somewhat dear to assert its right in that uncivilized country."
"The sentiments expressed were somewhat unfeeling, I must confess," said Maximilian. "But do not let that tinge your fair cheek with a blush of shame, my gentle Valentine, for I can assure you that although in a different way, my father was not a jot or tittle behind yours in the heat of his political expressions. 'Why,' said he, 'does not the emperor, who has devised so many clever and efficient modes of improving the art of war, not form a regiment of lawyers, judges, and legal practitioners, sending them in the hottest fire the enemy could maintain, and using them to save better men?' You see, my dear Valentine, that for mildness of expression and imaginative benefits there is not much to choose between the language of either royalist or Bonapartist. But what said Monsieur Danglars to this burst of party spirit on the part of the Procureur du Roi?"
"Oh, he laughed, and in that singular manner so peculiar to himself, half malicious, half ferocious. His smile even has always made me shudder. It has so very unnatural a look. He almost immediately rose and took his leave. Then, for the first time, I observed the agitation of my grandfather. And I must tell you, Maximilian, that I am the only person capable of discerning emotion in the paralyzed frame of my poor, afflicted relative, and I suspected that the conversation that had been carried on in his presence, for no one ever cares to refrain from saying and doing what they like before the dear old man, without the smallest regard to his feelings, had made a strong impression on his mind. For, naturally enough, it must have pained him to hear the emperor he so devotedly loved and served spoken of in that depreciating manner."
"The name of Monsieur Noirtier," interposed Maximilian, "is celebrated throughout Europe. He was a statesman of high standing, and I know not whether you are aware, Valentine, that he took a leading part in every Bonapartian conspiracy set on foot during the restoration of the Bourbons."
"Oh, I have often heard whispers of things that seem to me most strange. The father a Bonapartist, the son a royalist. What can have been the reason of so singular a difference in parties and politics? But to resume my story, I turned towards my grandfather as though to question him as to the cause of his emotion. He looked expressively at the newspaper I had been reading. 'What is the matter, dear grandfather?' said I. 'Are you pleased?' He gave me a sign in the affirmative. 'With what my father said just now?' He returned a sign in the negative. 'Perhaps you liked what Monsieur Danglars remarked.' Another sign in the negative. 'Oh, then you were glad to hear that Monsieur Morel, I durst not pronounce the dear name of Maximilian, had been made an officer of the Legion of Honour. Was that it, dear grandpapa?' He signified assent in a way that convinced me he was more than glad, that he was delighted. Only think of the poor old man's being so pleased to think that you, who were a perfect stranger to him, had been made an officer of the Legion of Honour. Perhaps, though, it was a mere whim on his part, for he is almost falling into a second childhood, but for all that I love him dearly and pray that he may long be spared to me.'
'How singular,' murmured Maximilien, 'that your father should apparently hate the very mention of my name, while your grandfather, on the contrary—' Well, it is no use to endeavour to find a reason for these things. Strange indeed are the feelings brought into play by the action of party likes or dislikes.'
'Hush!' cried Valentine suddenly. 'Conceal yourself. Go, go, someone comes.'
Maximilian leapt at one bound into his crop of lucerne, which he commenced pulling up in the most pitiless manner, under the pretext of being occupied in weeding it.
"Mademoiselle! Mademoiselle!" exclaimed a voice from behind the trees. "Madame is searching for you everywhere. There are visitors in the drawing-room." "Who is it?" inquired Valentine, much agitated. "Are they ladies?" "Oh, no, mademoiselle. I believe it is some grand prince, or a duke, or a king, perhaps. Stay, now I remember. They said he was the Count of Monte Cristo, and that he wished particularly to see you." "I will come directly," said Valentine aloud.
The name caused an electric shock to the individual on the other side of the iron gate, on whose ear the "I will come" of Valentine sounded the usual parting knell of all their intervals.
"Now then," said Maximilian,
as, tired with his unusual employment, he stopped to rest himself by leaning on the handle of a spade he had taken care to furnish himself with.
"Would I give much to know how it comes about that the Count of Monte Cristo is acquainted with Monsieur de Villefort?"